Possible volcanic eruption is just another natural hazard to be prepared for in Alaska.
Living in Alaska, we should all have some basic level of preparedness for natural hazards. We have windstorms that knock out power for days at a time. We have earthquakes that can happen. So we're kind of used to that level of preparedness. So for volcanic ash, it's really not a whole lot different than being ready for any other natural hazard.
I'm Jill Freitas.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 27th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertov and Ken Jones. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
Up KBOO.
Join me, Melissa Lesniak, creator and host of That Vegan Show, this Friday, February 28th at 11 a.m., where I interview two of the founders of Ratway Sanctuary, Lionel and Laura. They tell us about the rats they care for, and also we get to hear stories about Alice and Paige, some of the special rats that have been in their care. So tune in February 28th at 11 a.m. to hear That Vegan Show, only here on KBOO.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. Germany's election, good and bad news. President Zelensky of Ukraine tries to find a silver lining in the U.S.-Ukraine minerals deal. And Trump's pro-Russia stance reaches into Congress and the United Nations. First, Germany's election. As polls in Germany had predicted, Friedrich Merz will succeed Olaf Scholz as chancellor. His center-right Christian Democrats were the winner in parliamentary elections. But the second-place finish of the far-right AfD was just as big a story. The AfD won 19.5% of the vote, the Christian Democrats 29%, and Scholz's Social Democrats 16%, the Greens fourth with 13.5%. Although all parties have pledged to continue the firewall against forming a coalition with the AfD, a tradition that J.D. Vance specifically said should end, that party's anti-immigrant, neo-Nazi stance is bound to influence German politics from now on. The most likely next step is that Merz's party will have to form a coalition with either the Social Democrats or the Greens. Merz denounced U.S. interference in German politics, but that didn't sway Musk, who said in a social media post that it was only a matter of time until the AfD wins an election. Shortly after the election, Merz made clear that Germany's foreign policy will change to meet Trump's sudden abandonment of commitments to European security. My absolute priority will be to strengthen Europe as quickly as possible so that, step by step, we can really achieve independence from the USA, said Merz. I never thought I would have to say something like this on a television program, but after Donald Trump's statements last week at the latest, it is clear that the Americans, at least this part of the Americans, this administration, are largely indifferent to the fate of Europe. No statement more clearly captures the impact of Trump's embrace of Putin. Although U.S. officials have said the U.S. still supports NATO and its Article 5 commitment to collective security, Merz isn't convinced. Quote, I am very serious to see how we are heading toward the NATO summit at the end of June, whether we will still be talking about NATO in its current form, or whether we will have to establish an independent European defense capability much more quickly. Next, the U.S.-Ukraine minerals deal. What we know so far about the deal, which to the Trump administration is a payback for U.S. aid in the war, is that it offers the U.S. a considerable chunk of revenue from Ukraine's minerals, while also sparing Ukraine from much worse. President Zelensky says he's pleased that Ukraine is not presented as a debtor in the draft agreement. The agreement provides that the U.S. will receive half the revenue from future mining, not from existing mines, and that the revenue will be deposited in a U.S.-controlled fund. Trump has apparently dropped his demand for $500 billion worth of Ukraine's natural resources. According to Times report, quote, Ukraine has deposits of 20 of the 50 minerals the U.S. Geological Survey lists as critical for America's economic development, including titanium, lithium, and rare earths. Zelensky also thinks he has obtained an assurance of future U.S. support for Ukraine's security, though the reported wording is vague. The draft agreement says the U.S., quote, supports Ukraine's effort to obtain security guarantees needed to establish lasting peace. Previous drafts did not say anything about security guarantees. Zelensky and Trump are scheduled to meet soon in Washington. Trump's pro-Russia stance reaches into Congress and the UN. Not one Trump cabinet or other official has been willing to say that Russia invaded Ukraine. That simple fact has suddenly fallen victim to the president's reset of U.S. relations with Moscow. At the United Nations, the U.S. found itself odd country out when it tried to push through a resolution in the General Assembly that muddled the issue of responsibility for the war and simply called for peace. That resolution was so amended to make clear Russia's responsibility that the U.S. delegate had to vote against her own resolution. In Congress, Donald Trump continues to run roughshod, evidently believing he can do what he pleases without fear of an adverse reaction. That applies to his Russia policy. Opposition to Russian expansionism and dictatorship used to be a cornerstone of Republican foreign policy. Not anymore. You have to look very hard to find any senator willing to take serious issue with Trump's embrace of Putin and parroting of the Russian line on the Ukraine war. Even those precious few who have their doubts mask it with statements like, he has to be given space, or he didn't consult me. Note that these are the same senators who have consistently voted for more military aid to Ukraine. Take, for instance, Iowa's Senator Joni Ernst, who once said, quote, by strengthening and equipping America to push back against our adversary's aggression, Congress has stepped up to do the job this president, referring to Biden, will not. Now she's speechless. Among the few senators who have spoken up is John Curtis of Utah, referring to the defeat in the UN of the initial U.S. resolution that whitewashed Russian responsibility for the war. Curtis, a Republican, said, quote, I was deeply troubled by the vote at the UN today, which puts us on the same side as Russia and North Korea. These are not our friends. This posture is a dramatic shift from American ideals of freedom and democracy. Lisa Murkowski, Republican of Alaska, said, quote, the president clearly has the ability, has the authority to be negotiating, but I think many of us have suggested that negotiating peace on Putin's terms is not acceptable, unquote. But these senators are the exception. In other news, the U.S. is using spy planes along the border with Mexico. CNN reports that U.S. spy aircraft, such as the U-2, normally used to detect Russian and Chinese movements, are now mainly being used along the border with Mexico to detect drug operations. Moreover, the overflights are occurring far more frequently than any previous times. The aircraft have the capability to reach deep inside Mexico. But the flights raise a question. Will the intelligence they collect be shared with Mexican authorities, or might they find targets for the U.S. military to strike, as Trump has sometimes vowed to do? It seems that people like Tom Homan, the so-called border czar, are looking for a fight with the cartels. He told ABC News, quote, do I expect violence to escalate? Absolutely, because the cartels are making record amounts of money, unquote. The border area, which actually has seen a marked reduction in migrant crossings, may wind up being the scene of military battles. The saga of Uyghurs detained in Thailand continues. When Thai Prime Minister Pettongtong Shinawatra visited China in February, China's Xi Jinping proposed that China and Thailand are one family. Xi urged tighter cooperation on a range of issues, including law enforcement and the judiciary, quote, to safeguard people's lives and property. The Thai leader is said to have agreed. Xi also said, quote, China stands ready to work closely with Thailand to firmly defend the international system with the United Nations at its core and the international order based on international law, according to the Chinese report of the meeting. Nothing was apparently said about the fate of the 48 Uyghurs being detained in Thailand. If international law prevails, they should not be returned to China, but their lives are quite literally in the balance. At this moment, however, reports from Thailand indicate that the Thai government is going to cave in and send the Uyghurs back. Trump's immigration policy, whites, especially rich ones, preferred. Playing to white Christian nationalists and to South African-born Elon Musk, Donald Trump issued an executive order that prioritizes white Afrikaner immigration to the U.S. from South Africa. The justification is persecution of Afrikaners by the black majority, this after many decades of Afrikaner rule under apartheid. In South Africa, whites control 73% of usable farmland, and the so-called racial discrimination that Trump cites is actually a new law that grants blacks the right to seize abandoned or unused land without compensation to owners. Trump says the expropriation law amounts to a, quote, shocking disregard of citizens' rights. His executive order halts all U.S. foreign assistance to South Africa. He says white Afrikaners are victims of unjust racial discrimination, and he has ordered the Secretaries of State and Homeland Security to give white South Africans priority for refugee resettlement in the U.S. Elon Musk has, of course, weighed in. His upset seems to be over a South African law that requires 30% black ownership of his Starlink company. The law, which Musk calls racist, prevents Starlink from expanding in South Africa. I guess Musk doesn't like affirmative action. I have three other immigration-related news items. Trump has a plan for raising revenue. Sell $5 million gold cards to wealthy individuals looking for a path to U.S. citizenship, touting it as a way to dramatically reduce the federal deficit. These people will be given green cards and be eligible for citizenship. They'll be spending a lot of money and paying a lot of taxes and employing a lot of people, says Trump. Next, there's Trump's executive order to the Department of Homeland Security for an indefinite pause on refugee admissions to the U.S., but it has been blocked by a federal judge who said the order appeared to amount to a nullification of federal law and, quote, has crossed the line from permissible discretionary action to effective nullification of congressional will, unquote. The third item is Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem's announcement that all unauthorized immigrants in the U.S. who are 14 and older must register with the federal government or face civil and criminal penalties, including up to $1,000 in fines and up to 6 months in jail. It is hard to imagine that anyone would want to register, faced with deportation to Guantanamo or beyond, and with no assurance of legal protection. The administration is interpreting existing immigration law to justify its dragnet approach. Japan's auto exports will be hurt by Trump's tariffs. I noted last week that Trump's initial meeting with Japan's Prime Minister Ishiba Shigeru went reasonably well, but the trade issue was bound to cause trouble, and now, thanks to Trump's 25% tariff increases on imported autos, along with other threatened duties, they have to cough up to 3.2 trillion yen, that's $21 billion, in additional levies, making it harder for companies like Mazda Motor and Subaru to compete. Imports accounted for 44% of Subaru's sales in the U.S. last year, 52% of Mazda's, and 17% of Nissan Motors, according to a Japanese-based research firm. BRICS and dollars. Donald Trump has warned the BRICS group, that's Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, against refusing to use the dollar in international exchanges. But he has nothing to worry about. China and its partners in BRICS have a long way to go to outclass the dollar in international transactions. The dollar is actually rising in usage. In early 2025, accounting for just over 50% of all currencies used in the financial messaging service known as SWIFT. The next largest currency, the euro, constitutes about 23% on average in international transactions, followed by the British pound with 7%. And from the Words Have Meaning department, two items. First, the Trump State Department has quietly made two word changes concerning China. First, it is dropping People's Republic of China. From now on, it's China. And on its website fact sheet on Taiwan, the department no longer mentions that, quote, we do not support Taiwan independence. Significant? These changes may point to changes in China policy. Just the other day, Trump declined to say he would support Taiwan if it was attacked by China. Then there's the claim by Elon Musk's Doge service that it had canceled a $21 million grant to India for a project on voter turnout. Like many of its false claims of savings, this one was wrong, and it aroused the ire of India's government. The recent revelation has left me shocked, said India's vice president. The democratic process of this country was sought to be manipulated to dent the purity of our electoral system. Trump echoed Musk's supposed findings, saying, quote, what do we need to spend $21 million on for voter turnout in India? In fact, no such project exists, but the false story adds to others on U.S. aid programs that have caused worldwide chaos. And finally, a footnote on Brazil, where a former president is charged with insurrection. Following on recommendations from Brazil's federal police last November, the Attorney General of Brazil indicted former President Jair Bolsonaro and 33 others with plotting a coup. Brazil's Supreme Court must now rule on the charges, which could result in Bolsonaro's jailing and trial. That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening, and take good care.
Cable News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
For a centenarian plus one, Portland Youth Philharmonic, America's longest-running youth orchestra, still has a spring in its step. PYP continues its historic 101st season with a concert titled Spring Sunrise, taking place this Saturday, March 1st, at Portland's Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall. The program, conducted by PYP's musical director David Hattner, includes Lily Boulanger's Don Matin de Printemps, Edward Elgar's Cello Concerto in E Minor, which features 2024 Concerto Competition winner Andy Shin, and, to close the concert, Brahms' Second Symphony. As always, we're fortunate to have David here with us to preview Saturday's concert. David, this is PYP's 101st season, and you're in your 17th year as musical director. I've been previewing the concerts with you since season 95. It's no secret I'm a big PYP fan, though not a classical music scholar by any means. So just want to thank you for all our conversations and all your patience.
Well, I'm happy to be here, Ken. Nobody has to study anything to enjoy one of our concerts. Music is a universal language, and you can enjoy it on any level that you like, just to hear the beautiful sounds or to be inspired by hearing a piece you've never heard before or hearing something that you're familiar with, or just enjoying the particular energy that this orchestra uniquely has in our community with their youth and their sense of discovery, even with familiar pieces.
Oh, yes, and I'm a good example of that. Now, PYP's Spring Sunrise concert takes place on Saturday. So a few weeks before the official start of spring, you're getting a jump on the season. What do you look for when programming the annual spring performance?
Well, I think that March is sort of the peak of what we can achieve with the orchestra. As we get into the later spring, we have a shorter period. We have spring break in the middle of it, so we lose a little momentum in our rehearsal. So I like to think of the sort of the biggest piece will be for this concert, and that's where we're putting our Brahms Second Symphony, which is a different kind of challenge from some of the things we play in March. Sometimes we play a big, loud piece with a lot of virtuosity. Brahms is more of an emotional control challenge and a maturity of musical expression challenge.
Now, I want to get to the first piece, though, on Saturday's program. That's by a woman composer, Lily Boulanger. And you always do a great job showcasing works by women who might not always get the same recognition as the men. Previous PYP concerts have included pieces by Amy Beach and Polina Nazikinskaya, among others. So this must be especially inspiring for the young women musicians in the orchestra.
Well, I certainly hope so. The history of music has featured important roles played by women throughout, going all the way back to Hildegard of Bingen, back in very ancient history. And their accomplishments as composers has been undervalued historically. And Lily Boulanger, although she barely lived into her 20s, had quite a lot of accomplishment in that short life, and this is one of the last pieces that she completed before she died. Of a Spring Morning, On a Spring Morning is the name of the piece. It's barely 5 minutes or 6 minutes long, but it's filled with vitality and interest, and it shows why her talent was so admired and her accomplishments in her short life were so admired by the establishment, and as well as her very talented sister, Nadia, who continued her legacy by becoming a great teacher of composition. And she taught composers as important as Aaron Copland, all the way through people like Astor Piazzolla and even Quincy Jones spent time with Nadia Boulanger. She was very important. So, and part of her mission was to carry on the works of her sister Lily and keep them in print and perform them. So that we owe to her a little bit that we're able to do this piece.
Yeah, I read that actually this is Lily's very last piece that she composed, Of a Spring Morning. Just to talk a little bit about her, you mentioned she died tragically very young at the age of 24. That was March 1918. And I read she was the first woman to win the very prestigious Prix de Rome Prize for composition when she was just 19 years old. Did you come across her work through Nadia? You said that Nadia is kind of a champion for her sister's compositions.
Well, I think all of us who follow American music know the name Nadia Boulanger. If nothing else, that she was Aaron Copland's teacher, and then we learned that she taught several other important Americans. For me, I didn't know about the younger sister for quite some time, and then people started to play her music, and it was obvious that this is an important compositional voice, even if there aren't very many surviving pieces from her mature years. You know, music history is filled with the what-ifs of composers who died at younger ages, although often those younger ages are 32 to 35 in the case of Schubert and Mozart and so forth. You know, 24, I think she was, something like that.
Yes.
Very, very young indeed.
Now, the second piece on the program is Elgar's Cello Concerto in E Minor. That features Andy Shin, the winner of the 2024 concerto competition. It's on the program because Andy chose it for the competition?
That's right.
And do you know why he selected it?
Well, it's one of the handful of most often performed cello concertos, particularly for younger artists, you know, along with the concertos by Haydn and Saint-Saëns, and a few of the Tchaikovsky variations. Those are the ones we hear probably most often at the competition. We played the Elgar Cello Concerto, I want to say about 8 years ago, and we've heard it in the competition regularly, and Andy happened to come out on top this year, so we're preparing the work again. It's very closely associated with an English cellist named Jacqueline Dupre, who made her premier recording on it about 70 years ago. Of course, it's an English work. Elgar conducted it himself. He made a recording of it, actually, with Beatrice Harrison, a cellist of the time. So it's a work that's been around, and it's become really as part of the standard repertoire of all orchestras since Jacqueline Dupre brought it forth in the 1960s.
Even though he's better known among people like me for his Pomp and Circumstance March,
yes,
which is usually played at high school and college graduations, I've read that this cello concerto, many consider it his masterpiece, and it sets a very different tone than the Pomp and Circumstance March. It's described as a very dark piece that he wrote after the devastation of World War I, so not exactly spring-like.
I think that dark is not the word I would use. I would say melancholy. There's some optimism that's part of it. It's mostly, you know, a lot of people like sad music, you know, so I don't think of it as dark, something that's haunted like Shostakovich, where the music is actively scary and cold. It's very warm, but yes, there's a lot of sadness in it. And the cello is one of the great instruments to express this sort of emotion.
Oh, yes, the sound of the cello.
Yes, the great lament in the Jewish tradition, Kol Nidre, was set for the cello by Max Bruch. Shlomo by Ernest Bloch, which we did a number of years ago. The musings of Solomon, the king in the Bible, also with a lot of sadness. So the cello seems to always to represent this. And in this piece, although it has many joyful moments in it, has a lot of that characteristic.
When Andy plays this in the concerto competition, he's playing solo, right? There's no backing orchestra?
He will have a pianist accompanying him in the competition. So they will all bring a pianist to play the accompaniment.
And here he's being backed by the entire PYP orchestra.
That's right. We will reduce the orchestra slightly for balance, but yes, all of the sections of the orchestra are represented, including the brass.
So I'm thinking it must be exciting for Andy to have this full orchestra kind of filling in the gaps, fleshing it out for him and playing.
Of course, it's a great moment in any young musician's life if they get a chance to be a soloist with any orchestra, but PYP is special because we have the amount of rehearsal time to really make everything work together, whereas in a professional orchestra, the concerto is often rehearsed for about an hour or less.
Now, in addition to Andy's excitement, it must be a little nerve-wracking for the soloist, and you've been doing this for many seasons now. Do you have any techniques to help keep them calm and focused on the performance?
I always tell any musician, whether they're in the orchestra or the soloist, is like, just look at me, always calm, even when things are, you know, not going the way we want them to, which doesn't happen too often. I'll try to remain the most calm. That's what I've been trained to do, is to be when things are stressful, to be a source of calmness and steadiness, and that I'll be there to help. So yeah, they shouldn't do anything but just trust me to be their helper in any situation of that sort. But you know, the main thing is, if you've prepared, there really isn't any amount of nervousness that should get in your way. As long as you've really prepared properly, it should go well.
And a few nerves are not a bad thing, a little adrenaline.
No, remind you that you're alive.
Right. Yeah. Now, we should also mention that Andy, like several other concerto competition winners, is something of a musical prodigy. He's 15 now, and he's been studying cello since he was 9, and he's won several other competitions as well. Do you remember when Andy started with PYP, and did you recognize his talent from the very beginning, David?
Interestingly, because Andy is, he's always been very tall. So I did not realize how young he was for a while, because he seemed like he was as tall as a, you know, an upperclassman. And yet he was only in eighth grade. I found out quite a ways into this. He's only what? I guess I knew that he was, playing with much older folks, although he didn't look younger. And that's always, you know, very often we've had musicians who are considerably younger than the average in the orchestra. You probably remember another cellist, Kira Wong, who had been our soloist. She was in the top orchestra in sixth grade. And Hanami Froom, who was our soloist in the fall.
Yes, I interviewed Hanami.
She joined the Philharmonic Orchestra, I think, in fifth grade. So there's always a few people who, you know, they've advanced at a fairly young age. So it's not uncommon, but yes, we do notice. It's like, oh, that one's got a future if they're already playing with the older folks at such a young age. They usually continue to improve rapidly, which Andy has.
Before we close, David, I should mention that PYP's wrapping up a fundraising campaign to celebrate the 100th anniversary of its very first concert. That was on Valentine's Day, February 14th, 1925. Right. And the money you raise goes to support PYP's community programs, music education initiatives. You had a big pizza party last week after getting snowed out, I think, the week before.
That's right, yeah.
It's funny because it's sunny and warm today, and 2 weeks ago it was icy and snowy. But even though you're wrapping it up, folks can still donate to keep PYP going another 100 seasons?
Of course. We are a charitable organization, and the reason that we exist today is when people heard that concert on February 14th, 1925, they were so astonished. They could not believe that first of all, orchestra music, you didn't hear it all the time in Portland. There was a Portland Symphony, but didn't play that often. And to see their own community's young people assembled in just a couple of months and to play at such a level that people came together and they raised an awful lot of money to make sure that they could keep this conductor, this wonderful conductor who had started this thing, and to help them be able to purchase music that they needed and all the other things that go into keeping an orchestra. And they've, you know, formed a board of directors, and the organization has been on very solid footing from then until now. And there's a lot of excitement coming up for PYP. We got a lot of big plans. So people wanting to support us so that the people who are born into this community and grow up and are educated by our schools will have this unique opportunity to be in an orchestra that really plays the same way a professional orchestra plays once they're through our special rehearsal process, which PYP invented back there in 1924-25. Being the oldest youth orchestra, we can lay claim to some things that many other orchestras have adopted in the meantime, but we're done here first, and we still think nobody does it better.
If people would like to donate, they could do it online at portlandyouthphil.org/support/donate.
It's all tax deductible.
Well, David, thanks so much for talking with us today, and all the best to you and the orchestra on Saturday.
Thank you. Enjoy the concert, Ken.
I will. I always do. Thank you, David. We've been talking with David Hattner, musical director of the Portland Youth Philharmonic, now in their 101st season. David will be conducting PYP's Spring Sunrise Concert this Saturday, March 1st, at Portland's Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall, starting at 7:30 p.m. You can find out more online and purchase tickets at portlandyouthphil.org. This is Ken Jones, whose voice is usually a lot better than this, for KBOO's News in Depth.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations of programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for